For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. Okay, we are up to a new beginning, exciting beginning, section 3. There are 3 episodes. I gave this brief introduction last week. I'll just quickly mention it again as we set the context for what we're going to do. There are 3 distinct episodes that the Torah describes with Yaakov and with Esav in their interactions. The first one we studied already was their birth, and their conception, the struggles that Rivka had with them while she was pregnant, then their birth and the selling of the birthright. That all takes place beginning of Parshas Toldos. That's episode number 1 that we encounter them. And then the episode which we just finished last week, which is upon their father Yitzchak's death, or right around he thinks he's going to die, and he wants to bless them. He calls in Esav, tells him to get him a nice fresh meal, sends him out to the field. Yaakov, of course, comes in, steals the blessing, and then flees for his life at the end of the episode. That was what we did in a 3-second nutshell of what we spent about 6 months on. That middle ground episode of the two of them in the middle of their life, stealing the blessings. And then we encounter them as Yaakov runs away at the end of what we finished last week, and he spends 20 years with his uncle Lavan. It's a productive 20 years. He finds himself 4 wives and 11 children and great wealth. And then he comes back. He comes back, we're not going to actually study this, but he comes back based on Hashem's word. Hashem appears to him in the middle of Parshas, I think it's Vayeshev, and says to him, it's time to go back home. It's time to go back to the land that I had promised to your father and to your grandfather, to Avram and to Yitzchak. Return home, you have no place here anymore. And he passes that message on to his 2 wives, Rachel and Leah. If you recall from the parasha, we're not going to go through it in detail. The face of Lavan was no longer towards him like it had been before, the Torah describes. He could see Yaakov that he'd taken all this great wealth, and the sons of Lavan and Lavan himself felt that he had taken it from them, that all the cattle and the sheep and the servants that he had amassed really had been or should have been Lavan's and his children. Nobody was happy with his being there anymore. He's a big family, 11 children, 4 wives. And everybody agrees that it's time to go. They sneak out in the middle of the night. They do not tell Lavan that they are leaving. He catches up to them, and he accuses Yaakov of stealing his idols. And there's a whole episode over there, which again is not relevant to us. And then finally, Yaakov goes on his way, and Lavan gives him a blessing, which from the photocopies that you have in front of you, verses 1, 2, and 3, are the end of that episode in which Lavan arises in the morning, blesses his daughters, kisses them, and Yaakov returns home. And that's going to begin now where we are up to. Yaakov is now on his way back, 20 years post episode number 2, post the stealing of the blessings, and he's preparing to meet his brother Esau. We're going to go through this as we have done for all of our other classes, which is, it's worked so far, no one's complained, so I'm going to keep going. We're going to go through just the psukim, and that's why I gave you this. I don't even want you to have your blue stone chumash in front of you, because I know, I've seen you before, looking in the bottom of the notes.
I did not.
I saw you.
Oh.
So since I cannot trust you not to already look at the notes.
You're right. They can't trust me either.
So I want to look at these just the psukim. I want to look at it just the text, just the chumash itself. Really what we're going to do as we go through this, and we'll spend a couple of weeks going through this, is raising a lot of questions. For those who've been here before, this section of the episode that we'll learn is just questions. Lots and lots of questions. What are the problems that the Torah is like yelling and screaming at us that we need to be asking these questions? It's sometimes hard to hear those questions when you have those little notes on the bottom and you find an answer right away. You see what Rashi says. We're going to learn the Psukim. We're going to raise a lot of questions, and then we'll go back and we'll do Rashi, and then we'll do the Ramban, we'll do Rav Hirsch, and then hopefully we'll have a great understanding of this particular episode. In my never-ending quest to make this as easy as possible, I have color-coded. This third episode really has 2 episodes in it, and each episode has sub-episodes in it. So to try to make that easier, instead of having a whole lot of white sheets, I divided the two major sections of this third episode into different colors. The first is conveniently Perek Lamed Beis, chapter 32, which is Yaakov's initial approach to his brother Esav. How he's going to see, as we'll see, send gifts. He's going to daven. He's going to have a whole fight with an angel. There's a lot of stuff that goes on as he prepares to meet his brother. And then he's actually going to meet his brother. And that's going to be Perek Lamed Gimel, chapter 33, which is going to be in pink. So just to be able to distinguish the different components within this big third episode, the preparations for meeting his brother, and then the actual meeting. So this will hopefully, I hope in our minds, be able to keep it straight as to like which part of the section we're up to. Because within each section, there are little sub-stories, sub-plots within each story. So in any case, I hope that's enough of an introduction as far as the umbrella as to what we're doing. So right now we're going to be going through just the psukim of the first part of the third episode, which is Yaakov preparing to meet his brother Esav. Depending on how long this goes, I'm not sure, even sure if we'll even touch the pink sheets before going back in depth into the first part. We'll play that by ear and see how it goes. Okay, questions. So again, this is going to be open for questions. There's no right or wrong question. We're just going to learn through the psukim. We'll do it rather quickly just to get the feel of the story. Most of this you're probably on some level familiar with because we read it every year. But every once in a while, when you actually stop and read it slowly, verse by verse, you understand there's a lot of nuances that are lost when you're just getting there Shabbos morning and the Baal Kori is flying through the reading, even though you might hear it every year. But there's what to pick up on. So let's begin. The first, again, as I mentioned many, many times, the chapter headings are not Jewish. Chapter headings are Christians. When the Christians printed the Bible, the editors of the original printings needed to break up the text. It was very long. So they broke it down into chapters, which were easier to print on different pages and to however they study them. So they did them as best they felt it made sense. Sometimes they did it because of convenience, because it fit on a page. And so you end up with very odd chapter headings sometimes. Mostly it's fairly good, but very often it's a little off. This is an example in which Parshas Vayishlach, the way that the sages broke down the different parshas, begins in verse 4. You'll notice Pasuk Dalet Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanav. That's the beginning of the parsha. When Chazal broke it down, that's where they saw the new start. The Christians, for whatever reason, put the beginning of the chapter, three verses before that, with the end of Lavan, which was the whole previous chapter. Why these three verses got shtupped into the next chapter, I don't know. Sometimes, again, literally, Rabbi Berlwein likes to talk, sometimes it's just a space issue. They ran out of space at the end of the page. It wasn't computerized. It was handset, and it was expensive. If you had a blank page, you know, because you only used three lines, on that was very expensive. So they did things to make him fit. I don't know if that's what happened here. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. Our story begins where Chazal start our story, which is Pasuk Dalet, and that is where we will begin. The first three verses, again, are the end of as Yaakov leaves and Lavan had caught up with him and they had that whole dialogue. We're going to begin with verse 4. Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lefanav. Yaakov sent angels ahead of him, El Esav Achiv Artsa Seir, to his brother Esav, to the land of Seir, Sedei Edom, the field of Edom. Okay, questions, comments on this first opening verse?
Well, he sent angels. If that's really the translation, does he really have the power to...
Okay, right away. So the Torah uses the word angels. It uses the word, a malach. So it doesn't say messengers. It doesn't say agents. The Torah uses the word, he sent angels, which is as we see here. We'll give thanks to Chabad for giving us this very easy for me to print out text next to each other. So angels, that's what he sent. Does it literally mean angels? Is that an interesting, like, why would he send angels? It's just an interesting thing. We'll note, of course, Rashi will, of course, address that, for those of you familiar as the parsha goes through. Okay, so he sends angels to Esav, to the land of Seir, to the field of Edom. Now, we were given a number of other names here of Esav we'd been given prior. Esav is actually known as Seir. He's known as Edom. These are names that he's become affiliated with because of the places where he was. And we will hopefully touch it also. Where do we see Edom? When was Esav called Edom? At birth. In our first episode, when he was born, he came out a reddish hue. He came out fully formed and hairy, and they called his name Edom. That was a plural. They called his name Edom. It seemed like the people simply did because of the way that he appeared.
And the lentil face, was that Edom also? Was also
Adom, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And Seir... comes from the word hairy, which is also a word which was used in the original description of Esav, and it also is tied into the Medrash when in the Yom Kippur story, if you recall, we take two goats that look exactly identical, that were the exact same price, that were purchased at the same time from the same person, and we draw lots, and one is offered as a korban on Yom Kippur, and one is sent out as a seir la'azazel, sent off the cliff to be thrown off to its death as some form of a kapara. That's also called a seir, shnei seirim, the two goats, and there's a lot of connection between Yaakov and Esav, our two twins, who look similar, and going off in their divergent paths. And we have the Midrashim also connect the idea of the two Se'irim as well in that episode. And we see here again, Esav is referred to as Seir, to the land of Seir, into the field of Edom. Okay, Yaakov is sending these, we'll call them angels, these Malachim. What does he want from them? Pasuk Hey. Vayitzavo Som Lemor. So we would have asked that question in verse 4, Pasuk Dalek, well, what did he want from them? So the Torah tells us, what did he want from them? He commanded these angels, saying, Ko somrun la Adoni la Esav, so shall you say to my master, to Esav, quote, Ko amar avdecha Yaakov, so has your servant Yaakov said, Im lavan garti vo echar ad ata. I have sojourned, I have lived with Lavan, and I have tarried or delayed until now. I'm going to read one more pasuk to get the entire quote altogether, then we'll ask a bunch of questions. Vayivi shor vachamor tzon ve'eved v'shivcha. Now, look at all these things I have. I have acquired oxen and donkeys and flocks and manservants and maidservants. For eshlacha, and I have sent lahagid la'adoni to tell this to my master, limtzochein ve'einachak. End quote. To find favor in your eyes. So what does Yaakov want from these malachim, from these angels? To deliver what?
A message.
A message to be delivered to his brother, to Esav. And let's just summarize before we ask all of our questions. How would we summarize what's the message he wants to get across to his brother, to Esav?
That he has wealth.
A, I have wealth.
He's calling him master.
Okay, you're asking questions already. That's a good one. We're going to get to that in a second. I want to know, what's the message? In other words, you're Esav. You get this message, and then someone said, quick, give me a 30-second synopsis. What did your brother say?
This is where I've been.
I've been with my Uncle Lavan, our Uncle Lavan, for a long time. And I have a lot of things now. And then there's one other important point.
Well, to find favor.
And I want to find favor in your eyes. It's an interesting message. Now we're going to get to, we like to think about the gifts that he's going to send. But before he sends gifts, this is what happens first. He relays the message to his brother Esav. This is where I've been. Look at what I have. And I send this to you to find favor. Okay, now let's start asking questions. Yes.
Is it because Esav is so grounded in the physical world that that's why he thinks the physical things are what's going
to... Okay, well, we'll again pose this question. Like, why is he focused so much on this? Is that Esav, as that original from episode 1, their battle between this world versus the next world, Esav is more rooted in this world, so he's letting him know about all of the worldly possessions. Very good. Let's go back to Joyce's comment. How does Yaakov refer to his brother? How many times does he do that?
Twice.
How many times does he do that?
Twice.
Now pay attention to exactly where he does it. Now why? Let's go. Why would he do that?
Because he wanted to seem submissive, I guess, in some way.
Okay, that would be a fair explanation. He's attempting to, in some way, be submissive to Esav. He's on his way back to Esav's territory, so to speak. He's been out of town for 20 years. Now he's coming back. Which one of the two usages of master would be justified if that were the case? Go back over his two words. And he commanded them, saying, this is Yaakov's command to the angel, so shall you say to my master, to Esav, quote, thus said your servant Yaakov, I have sojourned with Lavan and tarried until now.
That one.
Right? We're missing one. Well, first of all, there's three. I have acquired oxen and donkeys, flocks, mans and maidens, and I've sent this to tell this to my master to find favor in your eyes. So three times he uses the word la'adoni, to my master. I'm sorry, let's get this straight. Twice he uses the word la'adoni, to my master. One time he uses the word avdecha, your servant. So three times in this very brief exchange he's submissive, yeah?
The ones to the malachim. Like excessive.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. In other words, there's a quote. What we're giving here is the Torah is telling us what Yaakov says to the angels, what they should then say to Esav. If Yaakov wanted to be submissive to Esav, where should he be submissive? When he says to the angels, this is what you should say to my brother. Tell him that I'm your servant, I'm his servant, or I'm he's my master. But even in the beginning, it says he commanded them, saying, "So shall you say to my master, Esav." Even when he's talking just to the angels, he says, "When you go find him, why is he being submissive and putting Esav on this pedestal?" Even when he's just talking to the angels, even if we would accept the submission in the way that he wants the angels to talk to Esav, that first one, I would use I would use that language of, it seems excessive. Why is he doing that? And we have the double language of my servant, or I'm his servant, and my master. So three times within this brief exchange, he refers to himself that way. One would seem excessive or unnecessary. And then we certainly have the actual quote into the what he wants the angels to say to Esau. Any other comments, questions?
Well, he hasn't seen him since the episode with the birthright.
Correct.
So at that point, I guess it seemed like he had the upper hand, and maybe he wanted to sort of smooth that over a little bit.
Okay, certainly I think that's going to be a role. He's certainly going to want, he knows that the reason why he ran was he was afraid of his life.
Right.
Certainly true. Okay, comments, questions?
But I would think that he would want Esav to think that Esav is superior. You know, he's making him think he's submissive when, you know, he's really not. He has great wealth, etc. So this should put aside some of the suspicions that Esav may have, saying that Esav is his master. You know, he's subservient, so maybe he won't start with
that. You're answering why he would do this.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Mostly want to focus on questions.
Well, I was asking
if that's right. Okay. Yeah.
I feel like the listing of everything can almost be seen too as who's being, like, is it bragging? Look at everything I brought back with me, or is it, I have all this, don't worry about me.
Excellent. In other words, let's rephrase that, Michelle's question. What do we expect, or what does he want Asaph to take from this? Like, what's the goal? I want to find favor. And what does Yaakov expect of Esav's reaction to be from, I've been away for 20 years, look at the great wealth that I have. And Esav should therefore think or say what?
Well, I think he would think he's his enemy now, but being, you know, saying, oh, I'm, you know, you're my master, so that's allaying his fear.
And his fear would be?
That he would attack him.
Okay, so that would be an option. In other words, that Yaakov is saying, you might think that I'm coming back to take over and to attack you, but no, I have all these things, but you're still my master. So playing off his wealth with his subservience, possible. Any other thoughts, comments?
I sit here and I have sent to tell this to my master. I don't know why I was thinking, I remember from the past, maybe I remembered wrong, that he wanted to give these animals and all.
So that's next. 100%. In other words, we're going to, after I alluded to that a few moments ago, that we're familiar with the gifts that he's going to send. This is not that. He's sending these angels, we'll translate them literally, with a message. And the message is, I want to find favor in your eyes. I'm not giving you anything.
That's right. Right now, Esav isn't seeing anything.
Esav is not being given these gifts. There's simply a person who comes and knocks on Esav's door and says, your brother Yaakov has lived with Uncle Lavan for 20 years. He's got a lot of goods. And he's telling you that to find favor in your eyes. So that somehow, Esav being informed of the great wealth of Yaakov, in the context of he's your servant, you're his master, would find favor in his eyes. That's what the Torah is telling us. That was Yaakov's goal or agenda. Yeah? So far, so good?
And he wants to create to let Esav know that he knows that he's the oldest. He recognizes it now.
Okay, going back to the subservient theme, I want you to know that you're still the older, and even though I got my stuff, okay, we'll see about that. One last comment, then we'll go on.
All right, you said yes, but maybe it's that even though I have all these things, it's not as important to me as finding favor in your eyes, making that.
Okay. Also, maybe it's trying to downplay. I'm really not so into the material stuff. Okay, but it's an interesting message. Let's leave it at that. So Yaakov sends these messengers, maybe angels, with simply a message. No gift. There was no gift card. There was nothing else other than, I got great wealth, and I want to find, I'm telling you this, or sending this message to you, to find favor in your eyes. Okay, let's see if this works or not. Verse 7, Pasuk Zayin. Vayashuvu ha-malochim le-Yaakov le-mor. The angels return to Yaakov, and they say to him, sorry. Bonu el achicha el Esav. We have come to your brother to Esav. Vegam holech likrascha, and he is indeed. So I have to flip back and forth. Coming towards you. The arba meos ish imo. End quote. And there are 400 men with him. So Yaakov sends the angels with a message of, I've great, great wealth, but I've come to tell you this to find favor in your eyes. The response is, we came to your brother to Esav. He is coming towards you, and 400 men are with him. Questions, comments?
Wow.
He knows his brother is Esav. Why did they repeat it?
Okay, so say something more, better about that. Had it, in other words, what are you pointing out?
We came to your brother, who happens to be Esav. Well, he knows that he's Esav.
Okay, you're asking that, but he knows that already. I would say stronger than that. What did Yaakov call him three times?
Master.
Yaakov three times calls him, my master, I'm his servant. The angels come back, and what do they say to him?
His brother.
We ran into your brother, Esav. Now, I don't know whether or not that's one of those, like, you know, that's the Torah's way of saying, like, Yaakov, you're Yaakov Avinu. Mm-hmm. You don't, whether or not you want to call him, you know, just call him Esav, but you called him your master, his master, over you three times. The angels come back and they say, we ran into your brother to Esav. Interesting that they switched from the way that Yaakov, even when Yaakov was only referring to them, he wasn't even telling them what to say to him. Even just talking to the angels, he already called Esav my master. And they return and they say, we spoke to your brother. Now, what do they say? What was Esav's reaction to the gifts? Or not, sorry, I don't want to act really. To the message of the great wealth, and I've come to find favor?
We don't know.
We have no idea. And it's very interesting what the Malachim report, what the Torah tells us, what the Malachim report, really leaves that blank. Was he coming out with 400 men to give him great fanfare and honor? Was he coming out to war?
He's coming toward him, nevertheless.
We know that he's coming toward him. Now, did Yaakov expect that? Here's where the questions we would ask. Yaakov's on his way back. Esav doesn't know he's on his way back. There's no email. They're not texting each other. Esav's been living for 20 years his own life in the mountains of Seir. Yaakov, for 20 years, has been out of communication, living with Uncle Lavan. Yaakov's now coming back. Does Esav know that Yaakov is coming back?
Well, it appears that he does.
Oh, it appears that he does.
Or
he's prepared all along.
Okay, so here we go. So, excellent question. So, are they reporting he's coming out to greet you that, like, we happen to, you're not going to believe this. We were on our way to Mount Seir, and he somehow got word that you were coming, and he's on his way to greet you. Textually, I think that'd be a hard shot to learn, because how would he know?
That's true. It doesn't say he's coming to greet you. It just says he's coming toward you.
Coming toward you. I think it would be hard to learn that Esav already knew in advance of Yaakov's approach. You have to remember, when Yaakov takes off, so it took 6 days just for the word to get to Lavan, who he was living with, but he was out in the field, that he had left. And Lavan catches up. He travels 3 days as fast. On the seventh day, they meet up. So it's not likely that someone else had gone up ahead of Yaakov to warn Esav that he was... It doesn't seem likely. We'll see if we see anyone who says that. It wouldn't seem that way. So it sounded like the response was, we met him, we gave him your message, and he's now coming out towards you, and he's got 400 men with you. That would be the simplest way, I think, of reading it, unless we want to say that somehow we knew and he was coming anyway, and they stumbled across him on his way. It's one or the other. Either somehow he knew and he was going out, or as a result of their message, he took out his men. So how do we understand how Esav interpreted the, I want to find favor in your eyes? We really know. The Torah doesn't tell us. The angels don't tell us. We don't know how he responded. We just, in terms of emotionally, all we know is what he did, which was he went out to meet you, and he took 400 men with him. What's the most likely response as to why he would take 400 men?
To attack.
To attack, right? That's the way to take like a little army. What's the only little problem with that?
He didn't do it.
No, well, who does Yaakov have with him?
He doesn't know.
Sorry, overkill.
Right, so depending on how much he knows here, Yaakov has 4 wives, 11 children, the oldest of which is, older teenage, maybe in the 20s, maybe, the oldest of which. The rest are, some of them pretty young. And he's got some servants. So it's possible that his servants number like 100, maybe. I don't know if he's that much. 400 would probably be a lot to take out Yaakov and his family. But if you're going for the intimidation factor, so then, all right. So how does Yaakov interpret this action of Esav?
He doesn't
know it. So he interprets it as an act of war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was clear that way. Maybe yes, maybe no. We're raising questions. We get the response from the angels that gives us no emotional response. We have no idea how Esav reacted towards it, other than his action was, I'm going out towards him. Or it doesn't say to greet or to fight, just he's going out, likrascha, going out to meet you, towards you. And 400 men are with him.
Rabbi?
Yes.
It seems in contrast, Abraham took 300 of his men to go beat 4 or 5 kings.
Correct.
And here, the 400 here. I have another question here.
Right, just hold on. No, it's pointing out that like an army was 318 men. It was an army with which Abraham fought 4 kings and their armies, and he had 318. And here Esav would be taking out 400 to fight a family with 4 wives and a bunch of little kids.
My other thing is, and you maybe checked it, but a human can send angels.
That was the first question we asked. We're not to see about that. So there's one word in this pasuk Zayin that I'm not sure what to do with, but since we're just raising questions, I can throw it out there. There's the word vegam, and also. The pasuk reads, we came to your brother to Esav, and he is also coming towards you. I don't know what to make of that just yet. We'll put that as a question. I would have dropped that word and said, we met him, he's coming. And he's got 400 men with him. Vegam, I don't know what to read into that yet, but it's an interesting word that, and also if that meant that he was already coming or he's coming because of us, but we'll see if we can find anything about that as we go along.
It sounds like he knew he was coming. Somehow he knew.
And a little bit that implies that and also he's coming, that somehow he didn't know about it and that he's got himself ready and he's coming with us. It's certainly a possibility.
We're almost like we're missing the emotional reaction. Oh, we're just going to skip that part of the message. And he's also coming out.
Correct. I think that's a big missing moment. Like, Yaakov's entire... Again, if we have to summarize, what was the entire goal of Yaakov in sending the angel in the first place?
Let him know he was coming.
What does the Torah say? To find favor in your eyes. My entire goal was, I'm looking to find favor in your eyes. That's what he states. I'm telling you about my sojourn with Lavan. I've delayed there. Again, we didn't even mention that. Like, why does he mention that he's delayed there for so long? But there's somehow he wants Esav to know, I've been there, and I've delayed there for a long time. I got great wealth, and I'm telling you all this to find favor in your eyes. So if that's Yaakov's entire goal, what's the one piece of information he's looking for when the messengers return?
Did I find favor?
Did it work, right? Did I find favor in his eyes? How did he respond? Did he smile? Was he excited? Is he angry? My goal was only to find favor in your eyes, my master Esav. And the messengers leave it out. They don't say yes. They don't say no. They don't say anything other. We went to your brother Esav. Again, brother, not master. And also he's coming out to meet you with 400 men.
It shows his wealth as well.
Certainly shows his power. I don't know his wealth, but certainly his power that he had this little army of people ready at the drop of a hat of his to follow with him. But it is of definite note that the one goal that Yaakov has to find favor is totally left blank. The angels, the messengers, when they return, say nothing about it. Not it worked, it didn't work. Just they don't talk about it. Yeah.
Do you think that one of the reasons he might have said that I was with Levin for 20 years was to show that he hadn't really amassed power, that he was he was at London. He wasn't out like trying
so to... So all these things are possible. In other words, in terms of how he's trying to set up the return, the commentators will certainly get into that. Let's move on. Let's get Yaakov's response. Vayira Yaakov me'od. So Yaakov gets the word back. How does he respond? He is very frightened. Me'od. Whenever we have the word me'od, whenever the Torah describes not just an emotion, but with the word me'od, very much it's giving us, you know, it's telling us what it wants to tell us. Yaakov is very afraid. Vayetzer lo. He was distressed. So he had two descriptive words. He was afraid and he was distressed. Vayachatz esho'o masherito. So he divided the nation, the people that was with him, yesatzom, yesabakor, v'agmolim, and the flocks, and the cattle, and the camels, lishnei machanos, into two camps. So what's Yaakov's reaction? What do we got? As I mentioned.
Well, it's a protective measure.
Okay. Right, because he's afraid. Torah tells us explicitly. He becomes very afraid and he becomes distressed. We'll have to figure out as we go through the commentators what's the difference between fear and distress and why does he have both reactions. Now, again, let's put ourselves in Yaakov's shoes. The angels come back. And what do they tell him? We gave the message. He's coming to greet you. He's got 400 men with you. And what's missing from the message? It worked. He's excited to see you. You found favor in his eyes. It's missing. It's not there. They don't say anything. So what's Yaakov's response? So he responds, how does he interpret the 400 men coming? He interprets it clearly as an act of war. He's coming to come out. He's coming to destroy me. That's why he's coming. So he's afraid and he's distressed. And then he goes into action. And what's his action? What's his plan? So far, he splits his camp into two. He splits the nation, literally the word for nation, meaning all the people that were with him, and his tzon and his bakon, his melim and his animals, into two separate camps. And then he continues, one more pasuk, and he said, Vayomer, Im yavo Esav el hamachaneh ha'echas v'hikahu, if Esav comes to one camp and strikes it down, v'hayo hamachaneh hanishar lisleita, then the remaining camp, the other camp, will be as a plato, will be as a salvation or as an escape. They will be spared. So he tells us explicitly, it's interesting how the Torah uses this particular model, like as if he said it to someone, like a quote. So it doesn't just tell us what he did, and it tells, and he said, why am I doing this? I'm splitting into two. It's almost as if, I'm making this up, it's as if, almost as if like one of the boys said, Dad, why are you doing this? You're making us weaker. We should fight him as a unified. And Yaakov said, no. My plan is, we can't fight him head on. We're overmatched. We can't do it that way. So instead, it looks to you like I'm making us weaker, but what I'm doing is, so if he comes and attacks one of the camps, he won't know that I'm really into two. He'll think that he's getting all of us. Meanwhile, while that camp is being slaughtered, at least the other camp will be able to survive.
They could outflank them from the back, like in a regular battle. 100%.
So he's thinking that they're not thinking, that Esav's not thinking, he's planning for war, that they're going to do that. He's going to stick as one unit, because that would certainly be the stronger thing, to have a strongest possible unit. And this way, if that first camp gets attacked, the other one will be able to flee and survive. So,
which is interesting. The other camp is not available to attack also from the back.
No, it's clear, again, it is clear that Yaakov is in defensive mode. He does not believe that even as a unified family he has the ability to take on his brother Esav. Again, I didn't mention this just today, but I've mentioned this a bunch of other times, and I'll mention it again now. I'll take this opportunity. The sages see in this third interaction, this is what's going to take us through the exile. This interaction between Yaakov and Esav. This is Yaakov having been in Golis in exile for 2,000 years, and now he's coming home. And on the way home, he has to get past his brother Esav, which represents Edom, Rome, Western civilization, the exile that we're in right now, this last fourth exile. This is going to be the interaction that's going to teach the Jewish people, how do you get past an Esav? That we're going to see this, all the threads are going to run through this interaction. So the first one that we'll point out is, Yaakov does not for a moment think he can take Esav on. Esav is bigger, stronger, more menacing, more prepared. He does not entertain for a moment, I'm going to fight him. He's in defensive mode. I'm going to split them so that one will survive. That's my goal. At least one will survive. To attack, even to do what you're suggesting, well, maybe when one is being attacked, let the other one out, flank him, and attack. It's not an option. I'm not fighting him. I can't fight him. I'm going to survive him. And he begins with this plan, and we're going to see various threads as to how am I going to survive him. He's going to have numerous plans, because there are numerous ways to do so. His opening act is he was afraid, he was distressed, he breaks up into two, and he says explicitly, as if he's talking to someone, again, I'm making it, maybe he was talking to one of his boys, this is the plan. If one of us gets attacked, the other one will survive. Okay, great, 100%. We're going to have to deal with that question. You're raising a good question, which we'll see. That question we can ask over the next series of Sukkim. Now remember, we didn't see this in time, but I mentioned it. Why is Yaakov going back now? Why now? He's been gone for 20 years.
Because
Hashem came to him when he was at Laban's house and said, time to go home. Return to the land that I promised your fathers. So the question you're asking is a good one. He's on his way back because Hashem promised him that it's time to go home. And now he's afraid and he's distressed and he's coming up with a plan that says half of my camp might be slaughtered, but at least the other half will survive. So we're going to have to deal with that question. That's the question we're going to have to deal with. And we'll put in the framework of, as far as Jewish history goes, we also have a promise that we're going to survive, and yet we're going to have to figure out how to deal with enemies who, at least in Yaakov's mind right now, want nothing other than to destroy us. Okay, let's keep going, because we're at the stage of raising questions. So let's keep going. So that's Esav, that's Yaakov's response, verses 8 and 9. Affright, distress, splitting up the camp. Verse 10, Vayomer Yaakov, and now Yaakov says again, Elokei Avi Avraham, Elokei Avi Yitzchak, to the God of my father Avram, the God of my father Yitzchak, Hashem Ha'omer Eli, to the God who said to me, Shuv Le'artzecha U'Moladetcha Ve'etiva Imach. I pray to the God of my father and my grandfather, the same God who said to me, return to your land and to your birthplace, and I will do good to you. Let's read the next three verses, because this is all part of his prayer, so we'll get the whole picture. 11, Yud Aleph, Katonti Mikol HaChasadim UMikol HaEmes Ashir Asisa, I have become small from all the kindnesses and from all the truth that you have rendered for your servants. Ki V'makli Ovartius HaYarden HaZeh, because it was with my staff that I crossed this Jordan, meaning on the first way over, out of the land of Israel to my brother, I came with nothing. V'ato HaYisi L'shnei Machanos, and now I am two camps. Again, I want to read the next few verses, and then we'll break them down verse by verse. Hatileini no miyad achim miyad Esav. Deliver me, save me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. Ki yore anochi oso, because I am afraid of him. Pen yavo vihikani eimal bonim, lest he come and strike me, and strike a mother with children. V'ato amartan, you have said, Hey Tev, Etiv Imoch, I will surely do good with you. The Samti Azarachok Kechol Hayom, I will give you children as numerous as the sea, the sand on the sea, Asher Lo Yisafer Mirov, that cannot be counted because of their multitude. End quote. So a long tefillah. This is a four verse tefillah, which in the scheme of Torah is a lot of words in this verse, in this prayer. Let's break it down now. Okay, so again, Esav, Yaakov gets the response from the angels of an emotional blank. We have no idea what Esav's thinking. We know he's coming with 400 men. Yaakov's response is fear, distress. He breaks up his camp into two, and then he prays. So let's break down his prayer. Let's start from verse 10, Pasuk Yud. What's the opening of his tefillah? God of my father Avram, God of my father Yitzhak, Hashem, who said to me, return to your land and to your birthplace, I will do good to you.
Who's alive at that time?
Who's alive? I think Avram for sure is not. Avram for sure is not. Yitzchak, 20 years he was. Did he live? I have to look up the numbers.
Knew that Yosef was sold, but wouldn't tell Yaakov.
So he was still alive. So Yitzchak would still be alive. It's a good proof. So Yitzchak's alive, but not Avram. Okay, so how does he begin his prayer?
God of my father.
Right, sounds like Shimon Asri. Excellent. He begins his prayer. Now, we do it because for very similar reasons. So how does he begin? He puts it in context. You are, I'm not the beginning of this line. You are the God of my father and the God of my grandfather, Avram and Yitzchak. So first he puts it in the context of the lineage, the context of where this fits in, which is what we do. Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. We also do that. We're not standing here on our own 2 feet, on our own merits. We're standing on the shoulders of the great forefathers that came before us. Yaakov does that here as well. Then what does he do? End of verse 10.
Saying what God has said to him.
Excellent, right? In other words, so I'm putting it in context. I'm the third in the line. You're the God already of my father, Yitzchak, my grandfather, Avram. And you're also the God who I have a relationship with. And you told me it's time to go home, return to the land of your fathers, and I will do good to you. So, now I don't want to put this in like, you're the one who said this, you have to protect me, but that's what it sounds like a little. You're the one who said, go back, ve'etiva emach, and I will do good for you there. That's what you promised me. You promised me that when I left. That was a dream, if you remember, the ladder and the angels going up and down. That's on his way out. Hashem promises him, if you'll be, you'll be true to my word, I'll be a God to you, and I'll give you all these good things. Now I'm coming back, fulfilling the word that you told me to go back, and you'll do good things for me. Okay, that's the opening of his prayer. Now, he's got three more verses still. Yud Aleph. Then he says, Katonti mikola chasadim u'mikola emes asher sises avdecha. I have become small from all the kindnesses and from all the truth that you have rendered to your servant.
That's trouble.
Oh,
it means
become
small.
Okay, good. Like, what does it mean to become small? What
it means? Humbled, I guess.
Okay, so it sounds like some type of humbled. I've become small. So we'll see the different commentators are going to learn different things, whether or not it means I have exhausted my reservoir of merit, I've become small, or... It's an interesting phrase. We'll have to see. There'd be many of the commentators, all of the commentators, I should say, are going to talk about this because it's such a troubling... This is why we look at this without the notes on the bottom, because all of you would already be seeing what everybody says, I know you, I've seen you do that before, because there's a troubling whether or not I've become small.
But isn't that the same word used on the grasshopper or the people when
they win it? Is that katane? I think so. What word do they say? We're small in their eyes. Did they use the word katan?
They're small in their own eyes. This is small from God's kindnesses.
I don't remember if that's that same word. Let's look it up.
Somebody's
okay, what does it mean, kindnesses and truth?
Yeah.
Kindnesses make sense.
The blessing, the birthright. That's one thing.
All the truth that you have rendered to your servant. Interesting. Okay, how does he refer to himself in relation to Hashem?
Servant.
Interesting. You're just putting it in context. How did Yaakov refer to himself in relationship to Esau?
Servant,
or he's my master. And here he uses the same word in relation to Hashem.
Yeah, but he doesn't call Hashem his master.
Right. He just calls himself, excellent. He just refers to himself as the servant.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Staff worries. Why do you need that?
So with my staff, I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. So again, in the big picture, the simple meaning is saying, I look at the kindnesses and the truth that you've done for me. He's actually describing, I have become small from your kindnesses and from your truth, because look, when I crossed over this Jordan 20 years ago, I only had a staff. I had nothing. I was on the run from my brother Esav. I was afraid he was going to kill me. So I had nothing but my staff. And now look, it's 20 years later, and look at what I'm coming back with. So many things that I have to divide up into two camps to protect myself. I have 4 wives, 11 children, all of this cattle and flock and servants. So I've become small from all of the kindness that you've done. So again, in our picture, like as we're trying to paint, like what are the components of the prayer service that he holds over here? So he opens up his tefillah with a context of Avraham and Yitzchak, and then my own relationship with you. You're the one who told me to come back. Then he goes in with, how would we define this stage of the tefillah?
That he's telling the relationship that he's the servant and he's
gratitude. Excellent. Gratitude, humility. Gratitude. Excellent, right? This is like a gratitude, humility part of the tefillah, in the sense of the gratitude of like, look at what you've given me. I'm humbled and small by the kindness and the truth you've shown me. I came over here with nothing and look at what I have. So we have the component again of the context of Avram Yitzchak, and you're the one who told me to come back. I am a nothing. I am your servant. I have become small. Look at what you have done to me. And now, Yud-Bez, the third component, Hatzileini no miyad ochi miyad Esav, deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. Ki yore anochi oso, because I am afraid of him, pen yavo vehikani eim albonim, that he may come and strike down a mother and children. All right, comments, questions. What do we see in this third stage? Here we have the actual overt request. I start with the context, God of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who told me to return. I come with humility. I'm your servant. You've given me everything I have right now. I had nothing without you, and look at what you've given me. And now I have my request, and this is what I need. I need to be spared from my brother. Good. That's our big picture, just in terms of the components. What's interesting in this pasuk?
That he names his brother.
Great. He does it in a double phrase. He says, "Save me, miyad achi." Miyad Esav, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. So not only does he refer to him here as his brother, which he was earlier he was referring to him as my master, here he refers to him when he's speaking to Hashem, he refers to him as just my brother, and he says it twice, save me from the hand of my brother, save me from the hand of Esav, and we'll see the commentators will pick up on that redundancy as well. Yeah.
It is different. He's choosing this influence, a mother with children. Why does he have to say that to Hashem? He knows that Hashem sees that. It's like that last powerful influence.
So he's very explicit in his fear. In other words, he says, save me from my brother from Esav. And he doesn't just say, because you know that I need to be saved from my brother from Esav. He says, because I'm afraid of him. And because I'm afraid he's going to strike down a mother together with her children. Which is, he's not even... what about him? I'm afraid he's going to kill me, which he probably was, but he says, I'm afraid of him, lest he come, vihikani, actually he says, and strike me, vihikani eim albanim. So the brackets there is trying to deal with the different translations here. How do we translate that? Penyavo vihikani, that he'll strike me, comma, eim albanim, a mother and her children, which as if he's saying two things. He's going to strike me and he's going to strike down her mother together with her. That's what I'm afraid of. So he's very explicit about what it is that he's afraid of, what he needs to be spared from.
It makes him very human for us to connect.
That certainly is.
All the faith that he has and all this kindness that he has seen, he's still human.
And he's afraid of his brother.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to go back and deal with your question. Like, I don't understand, but... which is really his next word. Let's go back to that question in the last component of his tefillah, Pasuk Yud Gimel 13. V'atamar, and you said, Etiv imach. I will surely do good. That's what you promised me when I left Eretz Yisrael for the first time 20 years ago on my way out. When I had the dream with the ladder, you promised me I will surely do good, and you promised me v'samti yizarachal kechol ayom, that my children will be as numerous as the sand of the sea, lo yisaf fermeiro, they can't be counted because they're so numerous. So I'm afraid that I'm going to be struck down, that my children are going to be struck down, and you promised
something good, not the dust of the earth.
Excellent.
The blessing is the
same. Okay, now the commentators also point out there are different promises given to the fathers. We have the stars of the heaven. We have the sand of the sea and the dust of the earth. Three different promises that are given to the different of us at different times. Here, Yaakov specifically mentions one, which we will talk about. He mentions which one? The sand of the sea. He does not mention dust of the earth. He does not mention stars of the heaven. He mentions specifically the sand of the sea, and we'll of course have to address why does he choose that analogy when all three are given. What's with that one? That's the one that he specifically focused on.
Is this part of prayer? You have to tell God, I will surely.
Excellent. So here's there, it is. It's a big quote. So now, how would he, there are four components to the prayer that he has, his tefillah. Component number one was his context. You're the God of my grandfather Abraham, my father Yitzchak, and the one who told me to go back. So there's a context, a relationship, a history. Then he goes into humility / gratitude. Everything that I have came from you. I've become small from all of these things. Look at how much you've given me. Beautiful so far, right? All the components that we would say is a perfect tefillah. Context, history, humility, specific request. This is what I'm afraid of. My brother's coming. He's got 400 men. I'm afraid he's going to strike me down. He's going to strike my children down. And then he adds this fourth component. If there was any component that I would say, whoa, wait, really? Are we supposed to do that? Like the first three, if I were to say, I have a personal need, I need a daven. I would parallel those first three components. That's beautiful. I would start with the context. You're the Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. We do that in Shemona Esrei. I would come with humility and gratitude and put it in the context of like, really, everything I have comes from you anyway. I'm a nothing. I'm small from all that you've done to me. Here's my request. This is what I'm afraid of. Would I then say, oh, and by the way, you promised that you were going to do this to me.
Like a whiny kid.
That's an it, right? That component we're going to have to deal with. That last line that he throws, everything was like really perfect along right until then, meaning in our eyes, perfect, makes sense, would be a scripted tefillah. And then he throws in and says, as if God didn't know this, or as if he forgot, and he says, and you said, I will surely do good, and make your seed as numerous as the sand of the sea that cannot be counted, and therefore it sounds like he's saying, you have to protect me from Esau, from my brother, because...
Isn't that really smart to twist God's hand?
So that, right now we're asking questions. That last component of the tefillah, we're going to have to look into and say, the three components up to that make a lot of sense to us. That would be the script of a tefillah. That last line, what are we to make of that in which he says, it sounds like he's saying, and you have to, because you promised me that you would, and therefore protect me.
But maybe it's just more substantiation for the relationship, going back to Avraham and Yitzchak.
Okay, very good.
You know, this is what you
so Janie wants to give an answer that we're misreading it. We are whiny children, so when we see something that sounds like that, it's like, yeah, it sounds like me. But that's not how to read Yaakov's words. Yaakov wasn't a whiny child. He wasn't saying, you have to because you promised. He's saying, we have this relationship. There's this legacy or this Abrahamic promise. Maybe. I'm leaving it as a question right now, that when we read his tefillah, and we say, okay, I'm assuming we should take from his tefillah and learn from it how we're supposed to daven in times of distress, that's an interesting thing. We need to understand that last component of, and you said you were going to bless me and make me as numerous as possible.
Well, he is only afraid of one thing. And he doesn't want God to change his mind and give everything to Esau. He wants to continue the line.
100%. 100%. Okay, let's summarize what we have for here. I'm going to call it a day. We'll pick up Mirtz Hashem next week. So what we have here is, Yaakov's on his way back. He sends an angel, the literal translation of Malach. And what's the goal of that Malach? Just a message. He just wants to get a message across. The message is, I want to find favor, and the way that I do that is by telling you I've been with Uncle Lovin for 20 years, it's been a long time, I got mass great wealth, and I'm telling you this to get favor in your eyes. How that was supposed to work? Remember, that's his goal. Angels come back, and they don't tell us anything about that plan. All they tell us is, we told him, he's on his way out to meet you, and he's got 400 men with you. Yaakov's response to that is one of great distress and great fear. And his immediate response is a defensive one. He splits the camp up into two, and he says, again, unclear to who, but he says, and the reason why I'm doing this is, lest we be attacked, at least one will survive. And then he offers up a tefillah. The tefillah has four components. First, he sets the context. God of my father, my grandfather, the God who told me to come back. He comes with humility and gratitude. Comes with a specific request, save me from my brother, from my Esav. And then he says, and you promised that you would surely do good to me and bless my children to be as numerous as the sand of the sea that cannot be counted, and all of our little questions along the way that we raise. But that's so far what we've seen. We will, Mirtz Hashem, continue the next component, which is actually sending gifts, which all of us are familiar with. That's the second. That's like what happens actually later in the story. He's not going to send gifts. And then we'll see what happens from there, and then the actual meeting between the two of them. All right. Have a great day. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.